to the Sinister Sisters podcast. I'm Felicia.
I'm Lauren.
We're best friends.
And we like spooky stuff.
And this is not our first time attempting to record this episode. We're having a little bit of an internet disaster.
I know. Really, our Wi-Fi is being so rude to us today that we are now recording for the first time in a long time without seeing each other's faces.
Yeah. How does Lauren feel about this? I'll never know because I can't read her face.
No, I mean, we're just trying our best here. Our Wi-Fi is not being kind. I think it's going to make it a very intimate episode.
Yes, yes. It's funny because we already explained all this once, but now we have to do it again.
So this is really acting.
Yeah, this is just a performance. We are a performance of ourselves. But let's try. So go ahead. Give us some recommendations, Lauren. What have you been watching?
I shall. So my recommendations this week, I think I may have recommended this on the podcast already, so I'm sorry if I did, but I watched again Tammy and the T-Rex. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
We did talk about it, right?
At some point, I think we did, yeah.
James did it in one of his secret screenings where like people show up and don't know what the movie is. And it's just such a fun time. I mean, it's Denise Richards like at her youngest and honestly like does a great performance, but it's basically that this mad scientist puts the brain of her boyfriend in a robot dinosaur.
It's amazing. It's like, it's just so over the top. And that's like, I think this is the, you probably know because you probably, James probably talked about it, but this movie had like kind of a PG version and then like has the uncut version, which is like very bloody and weirdly gruesome for like a movie about a giant fake dinosaur.
It really is so silly. And like, yes, this was the more gory version.
Excellent.
So it was, of course, yes, exactly what you want. But I had forgotten. It's just like, it just really is so bonkers. And it really is kind of unclear what kind of movie it is, but also in the best way. Like, it's very fun. There's a lot of gore. Denise Richards is like crying and acting her like most. But the best part is there's this like, I had forgotten kind of that there's this like gay black best friend, and he's so funny.
Yeah, he's great.
He really does a great job and like is, I don't know, just like adds so much to the movie that I don't think would be there if it was somebody else.
So
I really had fun. Yes. And then my other recommendation is another one that probably everyone has seen at this point, or I would hope everyone has seen at this point. But have you ever seen The Room? Like Tommy Wiseau's The Room?
Oh, God. Yeah. Travis made me watch it once. I mean, I could barely get through it. Like, I understand that people like bad things, but I was like, it's so boring. Like, I can't get through watching this.
I totally agree. I felt bad. I, like, on the way over, because it was, we saw it in like a Rocky Horror Picture Show way where like people bring props and throw them at the screen, and like the guy who plays Mark was there like doing a Q&A with James. So it was like, I don't know, he is such an interesting guy and has really like made the most and made like this whole career out of this one terrible movie that he was in.
That's
fascinating.
Amazing.
Yeah, like I'm like, I guess that's what I would do too. Like, he's the one, I didn't really get this. He wrote the book that The Disaster Artist, that movie with James Franco about the making of The Room, was based on. So like, I don't know. Yeah, he really has had this like full Hollywood kind of story where he made this one terrible movie and then it became like this cult movie. He wrote a book about it. That book got made into a, you know, Golden Globe winning movie. It's kind of incredible.
And I did see The Disaster Artist and I thought it was excellent. Oh. So, yeah.
Right? I mean, it's
like much better than The Actual Room.
Yeah, I don't blame you on that one. And I'm not sure if seeing it in the Rocky Horror way made me feel much better about it.
Oh, really? It sounds like it'd make it more fun, at least.
Yes, it definitely made it more fun. I was overwhelmed. I guess there's just like a whole group of people. Like, people knew every single word.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
yelling at the screen. No, like I almost felt like I like wasn't like I was like, I'm not in on the joke. Like I don't get it quite enough.
I think you and I have a very similar sense of humor. And I feel like that's not necessarily our sense of humor.
Exactly. And it's like, I feel like a little weird about it sometimes too, where I'm like, are we just like making fun of Tommy? Like, I feel kind of bad. Yeah. I don't know.
Oh my gosh. We're so similar. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like almost gets like cringy for me. But honestly, yeah. I'm glad that I went and it was fun to like hear the guy, the actor Greg, talk about it. But I, you know, it's a really specific experience. And I think you have to also be like appropriately liquored up for it, but that's my recommendations this week.
I love it. For my recommendations, I have one that is just going to delight you, and it's that I finally watched Love on the Spectrum. It was incredible.
Isn't it so sweet?
It's so sweet. And it's funny because I already actually was following, because I watched the US version. And I was already actually following Abby on TikTok because like her TikToks had like come up for me. And I thought, I was like, oh my God, this girl's so amazing. And so I had followed her. And then we turned on the show and I was like, oh my God, that's Abby.
She's a celeb.
She's a celeb. And then like to see like which couples worked out and which people are still looking for love. My favorite was the older man. What's his name? Steve. Steve, like there is a woman out there for Steve, and I don't know who she is, but please go find him.
I know he just has so, I mean, there's not a bad bone in that man's body. No. Like he will be so sweet to whoever he dates.
So sweet. Oh gosh.
I'm so glad you watched it. It's just the most pure form of reality TV too.
Yeah. Like I just, it didn't feel manipulative. It felt just like a genuine way of trying to help people. And I really loved it. I really did.
Yes. I'm so glad you watched it. And I totally agree.
Yeah. I have another recommendation, which I was going to say, but I guess I won't actually. So I watched Orphan First Kill.
Oh, I need to watch it.
I won't tell you anything other than, and now I have to switch. Okay. So this is what's happening now in my brain. So I was going to do one story, but I'm actually going to switch and do the other story.
Okay.
Because I'm mentioning this. Okay. So
perfect.
Orphan First Kill is really good. I really enjoyed it. I went in with very low expectations and I was like so happy and loved it. So maybe also going with low expectations. I don't know. Maybe that contributed.
But, maybe that's it.
Maybe that's it. But the movie, a lot of the plot points that happen in the movie reminded me of different true crime stories that I've heard over the years. And so I'm going to cover one of them today.
Ooh, yes. I can't wait. That's so exciting. Wait, can I ask a stupid question really quick? It is a prequel, right?
It's a prequel. Yes. It's a prequel to Orphan from 2008, I think, or 2009.
How do they? Because hasn't she grown up?
I know, Lauren. I know.
They just ignore it?
They use some CGI de-aging and they use a lot of like, I think angles and like she, like the actress Isabel Furman is pretty short. I looked it up, of course. She's like 5'3", but I think the rest of the actors like were wearing some sort of platform shoes to make her look smaller. And there is some de-aging, but honestly, like I wasn't really, I only thought about it for like the first like little chunk of the movie. And then I was so into the story. I really wasn't thinking about it anymore. So I don't know. I think it worked.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good recommendation. I can't wait to check it out.
Yeah. And yeah, and just text me along the way.
I will. I will for sure. Yes.
I'm first, right?
Yes, you're first.
Okay, good. Because here I go. So the one of the true crime stories that reminded me of Orphan First Kill is the story of Frederick Bourdin, who was a French serial impostore, if you will. And he looked up I'll get into the whole story, but he basically is most famous for impersonating a missing American child.
What?
And it's going to get dark. So I will say, and the only reason I will spoil this one part of Orphan is because it's in a lot of the descriptions of the movie, and it's also in the trailer. And that is that, so our main character of Esther gets from, I think she's in like Estonia or something, to America by looking up on the internet missing American children, finding one that looks pretty close to her face, and then waiting for someone, a policeman, to pick her up from like a random location. And then she tells him, "Hi, my name is Esther, and I am this missing child from America. Can you please call my family?"
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's how she gets to America. Yeah, it's genius. So, but, and I'm so curious, like, whether this has ever happened before, but this is the first story that immediately came into my head, because I think last year, maybe the year before, I watched the documentary on the Frederick Borden case, which is called The Imposter, which, you know, makes sense. And yeah, that film is from 2012, but it is such a good documentary. So if you want like more of the full story about what I'm going into today, that's definitely the way to go. It's just freaking, it's free on Tubi and Peacock, if that's helpful.
Yes. No, that's good to know. I will definitely be watching it.
Yeah. It's freaking crazy. Okay. So let's step away from Frederick Borden for a second, and we'll talk about the missing child he ends up impersonating. So Nicholas Barclay was a 13-year-old boy that went missing on June 13th, 1994. So he was from San Antonio, Texas. Texas! Oh, another connection.
Hey!
Texas
is dangerous.
Texas is dangerous, yeah. That's what we should do, a whole series of like scary things that happened in Texas.
It would be a lot of episodes.
Oh, no. Stay safe, Lauren. Okay, so Nicholas Barclay, he was last seen playing basketball with some friends in his hometown and seemingly vanished. So a little background on Nicholas Barclay. At first, when he disappeared, people weren't super concerned because apparently he had run away from home before. He had had some behavioral issues, and he had run into problems with the law already at his young age. But like petty crimes, like he had like stolen from some stores and done some things. And so he was actually supposed to go to a hearing at some point that year to potentially be sent into a group juvenile delinquent home. So his family thought, oh no, he's run away because he doesn't want to deal with the consequences of everything that's gone down here. Mm-hmm. And so his parents, his sister, brother, the authorities, they all at first were like, oh no, he's probably just run away. Well, we are sure he's going to turn up. He has like no more than $5 in his pocket. Like there's just no way he's not going to come back home. And because he's a kid and it's 1994, it's not like he has a car. It's not like he has a phone. He doesn't have a credit card. Like there was no way to figure out where he went.
Right.
And so they weren't sure like, okay, maybe he is staying with a friend. Maybe he's like hitchhiked out of town. Like who knows? And then when he didn't come home for a few days, that's when the Barclay family started to get really scared. And then the police started looking for him. So Nicholas Barclay never returned home. And I'm sorry to tell you this, but this is still an unsolved crime. So because ultimately, I know. So ultimately, we're talking about Frederick Borden today, but I did feel it's important to mention Nicholas's story. This is an unsolved crime. No one knows what happened to him. There are some theories that I'll get into later. So three years go by. It's very sad. It's very sad. So 3 years go by. And they get a phone call from the police station saying, "We have your son. He was found in Spain." And this family from San Antonio, Texas is like, "What are you freaking talking about?" And so the sister flies to Spain to meet with Nicholas and to bring him home.
So, okay. She really just went for it. Yeah.
She said, "This is my brother." Yeah. So it gets very strange. But so that's kind of where we are on the Nicholas Barclay side. Now let's switch back over to the Frederick Borden side. So Frederick Borden is French, and he's been nicknamed the Chameleon because he has assumed at least over 500 false identities in his life.
500?
Yes. According to him, he was typically a new person every week. And up until he started pretending to be Nicholas Barclay, he usually made up these characters that he would become. And when he was young, so he looked pretty young for his age. So after he turned 18, he started posing as, like, you know, a street kid, basically, to get put into foster homes and what is the I don't think they use the word orphanage anymore. Is that true? Group homes. Yeah. I don't know. So to basically get free lodging and free meals and to get taken care of. So when he was 18 up until his early 20s, he was basically pretending to be like 14 or 15 years old and moving through all these different countries' childcare systems in many countries all around Europe. So yeah, it's really wild.
I can't believe it.
Yeah. And so he ends up in Spain, and apparently the authorities have kind of caught on to what he was doing. So he felt like he needed to disappear because he was like, basically my options here are to go to jail for, you know, obviously faking identities, but also for using all these different countries' welfare programs to his benefit that he didn't actually need. And so he says, I either go to jail or I get out of here. So apparently what he started doing was calling different police stations in America and asking about different missing children.
Wow.
Which I thought was weird. But I guess it's the 90s. So in the movie of Orphan First Kill, she's using the internet. But I guess Borden had to use the phone. And he hears about Nicholas Barclay from San Antonio, Texas. So he, is once again, like, pretending to be, like, on the street. A policeman comes up to him, and he acts really distraught and confused and says that his name is Nicholas Barclay. And so they call the U.S. Embassy. And I guess maybe because it's the 90s, like, they haven't actually, like, sent a picture of him or anything like that to the Barclay family. They just believe him, I guess, and then make the calls to get the sister to come and take him. So they're like, yeah, this is him. So
wow.
Frederick Barclay, by the way, and you can see this on our Instagram page. Sorry, I just used their two names together.
I know. I was like, wait. They're one person now.
Borden. Now they're one person. No. So Frederick Borden has dark brown hair and brown eyes and a French accent.
Yeah, what?
Kills me. Nicholas Barclay, blue eyes, blonde hair from San Antonio, Texas.
What the heck?
I know. So Frederick Borden, before the sister gets there, he bleaches his hair blonde and he basically tries to stay very covered, like wearing hats and big jackets. And I think the idea for him was sort of like, oh, I'm so, like, emotionally distraught. I just need to be covered. Don't look at me. I'm sad or whatever. But also he was like, don't look at me. I don't look anything like this kid. And yes. Because there's been a lot of interviews with Frederick Borden, because he's actually out of jail now. But sorry, spoiler alert, he goes to jail. But I think he's back in France now, and he has like two kids and whatever. But so he's given a lot of interviews about this time in his life. And he said, like, once the ball was rolling, he just kind of had to go with it. He was like, I think he's maybe has some like other issues going on. But he was like, once they called the U.S. Embassy and the sister was on the plane, he was like, okay, I guess this is who I am now. I have to just go for this.
I cannot. I mean, the sister believes him?
Yeah. So the sister gets there and hugs him and is holding him and is like, this is my brother. This is my brother.
Dang, girl. She didn't even. Yeah. I mean, you would think if it was your brother,
you would think you would know. And so that's another question that comes up when people talk about this case is, why was the Barclay family so quick to accept Frederick Borden's, when it's clearly they look so different and he has a friendship. Like, why were they so willing to accept this? So,
but also, like, it's not like, I don't know. It's not like if they, I don't know, it's not like their kid was acting out so much. They're like, we'll just accept this random stranger. It's like, there's another option in there, which is, yes, like, not to have anyone.
Yeah, well, I'll get into the big stuff here. But before that, so basically the story that Frederick Borden says is that he was stolen and he was put through a child prostitution ring, and that at some point while he was in there, they put this stuff in his eyes that altered his eye color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they also said that he was not allowed to speak English, so he had to speak French, which explains his accent.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I, anyone that believes this, I'm sorry.
I know. It's bad. But people did. Like, so he lived with the family for almost 5 months. They were on TV because also people were, I mean, the local news stations, the local community were so excited that Nicholas Barclay had been found after all these years. So like they were on TV and he was giving interviews as Nicholas Barclay. God. And then a local private investigator was watching one of the TV interviews that they had been filming of the family. And he was looking at a photo of Nicholas. He's looking at this Borden on the show. And he said what actually really stood out to him was that their ears were really different. And I said, interesting. Mm-hmm. I think all of them are really different.
Interesting. Not but, his hair color or body shape or
yes,
eyes.
But, you know, it was the one thing that he felt that couldn't be explained away with some sort of lie, because like the ears could only be this different if he had undergone some like crazy plastic surgery, which just didn't make any sense. And so then the FBI, he contacts the FBI and they court order fingerprints and DNA from Frederick Borden. And at some point also, so even before the FBI did this, the investigator, there's an interview with him on 60 Minutes. And he talks about he sits down with Frederick at a diner in town and they're talking. And Frederick Borden says, I know I'm not Nicholas Barclay. And you know I'm not Nicholas Barclay. And no one else seems to know. Right?
It's freaking crazy. I mean, that's insane.
And that's sort of where he confesses. And I wonder if it's – so there's a couple of reasons I wonder why he confessed. One, I thought maybe it's because he felt so bad for the manipulation of this family. And pretending that their child is no longer missing and or dead. But what he says, what Frederick Borden says, is that he actually came clean because he found out that Nicholas Barclay is dead. And he said that the family confessed to him that they also knew that he was not Nicholas, because the oldest brother, who had had some drug problems, had accidentally killed Nicholas, and the family, to protect the family and the rest of them, they covered it up and reported him missing.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
That is juicy, and also I believe it.
Yes, it is so dark. And so this hasn't been proved. The family, of course, denies it. And Frederick Borden says, you know, like, obviously, I'm a criminal. Who's going to believe me? But this is what they told me.
I believe that. I think that's 100% real. Why
it
else
sounds
would you,
right
like,
to me.
You got to know if that's your brother or your child.
Absolutely. And it's only been 3 years. So it's like 13 to 16. Like, there would still be some features that would be the same. And so even in like grief or relief or whatever that family was going through, they had to know pretty quickly that that was not him.
Yeah.
Especially once they're living all in the same house together. Like, it just feels way too suspicious.
I totally agree. That I think that seems like the most likely explanation.
Yeah. So he pled guilty. And just also, America gave him a passport that said Nicholas Barclay. He had a passport.
It's ridiculous.
Before they did fingerprints, before they did any DNA testing, they were like, that's him.
That's the weirdest part of the story to me is how quickly they're just like all like, okay, let's get him from the other country. That's probably him. Yeah.
Like the U.S. government being like, yep, okay, sounds good. Right.
Yeah, we don't give passports to any, like, it is so hard to get a visa here or like to get citizenship that I'm just like, what for this random man?
This was before 9/11, which I do think changed a lot of that. But still,
that's a good point.
I don't think they were giving them out so willy nilly. So he pled guilty to passport fraud and to perjury, and he was imprisoned in California for 6 years. And then he, in 2003, goes back to France. And as soon as he gets there, he assumes the identity of Leo Bailey, a 14-year-old French boy who had been missing since 1996.
Oh my God, he just went back to his same games.
Yeah. And this is why I wonder if he has some sort of like mental something going on that, because he's been doing this since he was almost a kid. Like, he's never really been himself. So it just is like, I wonder if there's like something going on here that he is just drawn to doing this.
One thing that he has to be.
Yeah. One thing he has mentioned in interviews that he didn't receive love or affection as a child. And whenever he pretended to be an orphan, he got all this love and affection and people taking care of him and people feeling bad for him. And so I wonder if like maybe he became like addicted to that feeling.
Yeah, that could very well be. It was even when you were talking earlier about him like doing this, I'm like, this just seems like so much more work than like getting a job.
I know. Oh, I know. But okay, so that's not even his last one. So pretty immediately, they DNA tested him and they were like, okay, you are not Leo Bailey. Stop. 2004, back in Spain, he claims to be an adolescent named Ruben Sanchez Espinoza, whose mother had been killed in the Madrid bomb attacks. And the Spanish government was like, no. And they deported him back to France. So he keeps getting deported back to France. This is like the story of his later years. And then in 2005, he passed himself off as Francisco Hernandez Fernandez, which is a fun name, a 15-year-old Spanish orphan. And he even spent a month in the college Jean Monnet, a junior high school in France, dressing as this teenager in 2005.
Wow.
So at that point.
Wow.
He is like almost, let's see, 2000. He's almost 40 years old.
Yeah, still doing this.
Or maybe he was less. He was born in 1974. What's 2005?
30.
Okay, JK, he was like 30, not 40.
31.
Math is hard. Yeah. Okay, math is very hard.
But still,
me.
Full adult man.
Yeah, just pretending to be a teenager. And then he did go back to prison for some amount of months. And then in 2007, he got married. To a French
that
woman.
Is still, like, who is that? Who is that woman?
I don't know. Her name is Isabel. I don't know. And they must have had more children. I thought I read they had two children, but this says they have five children.
Wow.
Oh, gosh. There's a lot of info on this page. And in 2007, Borden made a Facebook post saying that Isabel had left him for another man. So that's very sad.
No, good on her.
Yeah. Yeah, true. So Borden, at some interview in 2008, said that he would never impersonate anyone again, but I'm not really convinced.
Yeah, and, I'm not convinced either. Wait till he starts impersonating his own children.
Right? Oh my gosh, that's such a good point. Yeah, and so the Barclay family, by the way, has never been charged for Nicholas's death. I'm sure they were investigated at some point once these claims came out, but nothing has really happened with that. So Nicholas Barclay is still considered a missing child.
Wow. That is so crazy and so sad and wild.
So sad. Yeah. And now it's also like this sad thing where it's like there's, I mean, even in today's episode, now we're spending so much time talking about this insane imposter while we still don't know what happened to Nicholas Barclay.
Yeah. Oh, that is just really, yeah. If he was murdered by his family, that is so sad. Or accidentally killed.
I know.
Oof, it's very scary. Man, that was one of my favorites that you've done, though. That was so wild.
Thank you. Yeah. It's funny because like this story in particular. Because I watched the movie, I got, like, really obsessed with the story, so I didn't even take any notes. I was just like, I know this story. I know this one really well.
Just telling it from heart.
I'm pulling the docs up for the dates, but, like, man, I know this one. It's crazy.
Well, thank you for doing it. That was really wild.
Thank you. Yes, thank you so much.
Amazing. Okay, well, I'm gonna keep with the one that I was going to do. I think it's fine. All of ours, we like, you know, a little difference in our stories.
They never really match up.
No, they don't. But I don't know. I think it means that we're, you know, we're just truly led by passion for telling the story. We're not tied down.
Oh yeah.
So this week, I'm doing a recommendation from my dad, actually. So he sent this my way, and I'm going to focus mostly on just the story of Helen Hadsell. So she was a super interesting woman that, like, basically became famous by just winning a lot of contests. So, yeah, it's not going to be a super sinister story.
Yeah, me too. I want to win contests. Yeah, come on.
Well, maybe you can learn from her.
Did you
example.
See that the person that won the Mega Millions hasn't claimed their money yet or something?
No.
Yeah, I don't know. Travis is telling me something about that. I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh. No.
Sometimes I forget we're podcasting.
And not just chatting. I like
it. Not just chatting. Okay, go ahead.
I think that's good. But Helen was born in 1924 in South Dakota. And basically, like, her life was relatively normal until all of this contest winning started. So just to give you a little bit of backstory, she ended up marrying a man named Pat Hadsell, who was from Denton, Texas, which is super close to me here. And they settled in Grand Prairie, Texas. But she was kind of classic, you know, I guess like 50s mom. So she was a homemaker, president of the local community choir, a Girl Scout leader, on the board of her local PTA, real kind of, you know, 50s housewife stereotype.
Also, I mean, I just realized our stories do have in common that they're both take place in Texas. Boom.
Oh, there you go. There you go. It's a Texas week.
Yep.
So she eventually became the society news editor for the Irving News Record when they moved to Irving, Texas. So she definitely had writing skills, which will come in, but, you know, otherwise pretty much just stereotypical housewife. So I didn't really get this, but in the 50s and 60s, contesting became like this, like, wild or widely done activity where basically people would fully dedicate their time and efforts towards winning these sweepstakes of any kind. Yeah, I didn't really get that it was like this became people's hobby or, you know, some people their whole focus. So they were known as, you know, contest bugs or contesters. Where they would just, you know, either do these like random sweepstakes where they just like pick somebody to win, or there are these consumer skill contests where you basically had to, you know, submit some kind of writing about a product and they would pick somebody based on that. Uh-huh. So her family started entering contests in 1948 as kind of this like family activity where they would just like enter these contests, and her good luck started when she won a Tony Home permanent kit in 1949 from a contest run by Skillern's departmental drugstores. But for the first 10 years of doing this, they really almost never won. So it took her a little bit to kind of figure out the like how to win.
She paid her dues.
She paid her dues, exactly. So her family ended up taking this correspondence course in contest writing where they kind of started honing their writing skills. This is so crazy to me that people were this focused on winning.
Yeah.
But they, in 1957, kind of started this like streak of winning where her, even like her son, won some toy guns for naming a pony. She won an electric food mixer for coming up with a name for a new kind of cake. But when, like, when she was interviewed by the newspaper, she was like, it's actually not a big deal because I won two other mixers in contests the year before that. So she was becoming this, like, just regularly winning these kind of smaller contests. And she was eventually also selected to be president of a Dallas area, like, contesting club known as the Compatriots. And it was like this whole group of writers that were now focused on winning these contests. So it was a big deal. Oh, isn't that so weird? I just can't get over it. That
I think
was like
actually an episode of Wife Swap where one of the families was like really into contests or something.
Wow.
Or maybe it was couponing. No, I think it was contest. I don't know. Go ahead.
I was just about to say it feels kind of like that, like coupon culture to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like housewives that like have some time on their hands to like get super into this one thing. It's really interesting. But in early 1964, they had really won a bunch of different prizes, from lawnmower blade sharpeners to trips to Disneyland, Washington, D.C., and Venice. But their kind of first, I guess, like, you know, bigger media kind of win was they won a house that the, so the Formica Corporation had an exhibit where they were showing a house at the New York World's Fair in 1964 and 65, where they, like, this company had built this house where the interior walls and appliances and furnishings were all made from the company's laminated plastic. So it's kind of a specific house winning experience. But the company ran this $100,000 contest where the grand prize was a $50,000 replica of the house that they would build anywhere in the U.S., including paying for the lot. So it was kind of a, big grand prize. And so contestants had to write what they liked about the house and what suggestions they had for future Formica products. And so 1.5 million people entered, but Helen won.
Wow. So, 1.5 million? That's some crazy odds to win that. That's wild.
I know. And also, like, all those people, like, wrote what they liked about this house. I don't know. It's all very,
I guess,
it's all very funny to me. But they won this house. And so they built her a house in Irving, Texas. And so this kind of marked this big change for Helen, where she had just won all these different contests. And about 2 years after she had won the house, she started to totally switch her focus to be on mind control. So the...
Come again?
I know. It's a real plot twist, but I'll show you how it kind of links together. So the first kind of thing she did was she sponsored this seminar in Dallas on mind control, where they brought a leader of the seminar, was brought over from Mexico. And then she just kind of started just like jumping in full force. So she was part of a lecture series in Dallas on subjects related to psychic abilities and mental potential. And she always, like, her focus when she was giving these seminars was really on the power of positive thinking. And so she started to use the fact that she had won all these contests and kind of sell this idea of positive thinking. And so, you know, she was the editor of a mind control newsletter for a while. And she just kind of, like, stopped focusing on entering contests. She wrote a book about her experience that was called The Name It and Claim It Game with Maneuvers for Wishcraft, which gave like her tips on how to win contests. And it was all this philosophy of, if you believe you can win, you will. So there's like I know. There's a lot of back and forth on like whether she used a lot of these things that she like talked about in her later life to win all these contests, or whether it was just kind of like good luck and good writing skills. It's really weird to me that, like, I guess she didn't want to give away her, you know, like, you could think about it as like she didn't want to give away all these like tips and stuff while she was still in the contest winning game, I guess. But it's like, why weren't you talking about that when you were actually winning the contest?
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, I have as many thoughts about this. Because it kind of, maybe like every generation has this type of thinking that comes up. Like, I feel like ours right now is like manifesting, right?
Yes.
It's like manifest your greatest life or whatever. But I will say, recently, I went to a bar. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell the story. It's short.
Tell it.
They had one of those wheels that you spin. And mm-hmm. every number was like a different prize. And some of them were like good prizes and some of them were like really weird prizes. Or like a challenge. Now you have to do this weird activity in front of everyone. But I literally up to it and I was like, I'm gonna win a t-shirt, so I'm gonna get 13. And I spun it and of course I got 13 and I got a t-shirt. And I was like, and I feel like when I do that in my life, when I just like proudly proclaim something as truth, I feel like it does happen sometimes. I don't know.
Yeah. I kind of believe in manifesting. I don't know. Yeah. I think it does matter.
Yeah. And I think if nothing else, it like clarifies in your mind what you want. And then you start behaving mm-hmm. in ways that's going to like make your life closer to that because you're thinking about it. Maybe.
Yes. And I think it's kind of the horoscope thing of like, if you start trying to manifest, like you're only going to notice when it lines up. I don't know. It's like you're not going to be like, I manifested this and it didn't happen. Like, I feel like you're more likely to like draw comparisons between like what you know.
What's that called? Anyway. Is it the yellow car theory or something? Or something like that, where it's like if you – like for example, like for a while I was like, I really want a black Jeep Wrangler. And then that's mm-hmm. all I could see on the street. I would see like 20 a day. Yeah. And I was like, why? So I feel like maybe that's, I don't know. I think they're all connected somehow.
Yes, totally. So the next kind of thing that this woman got into, if you couldn't tell where we were going, by 1972, she had established this relationship with Jose Silva, who had this thing called Silva Mind Control, which was like this new approach that she was super excited about. And so she kind of jumped in and received training in this approach. She eventually started teaching and eventually took over as this, as like his total contact point for Dallas seminars in 1980. So really quick, I'm just going to talk about Silva Mind Control because it feels one click away from Nixium to me.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like that idea. But
interesting.
Yeah. So it's like a little culty. So he started experimenting with this mind control thing because he wanted to increase his children's IQ. So... Wow. I know, right? I'm like, I hope that's not me as a parent. Like, but he became convinced through like working with his daughter that she suddenly had clairvoyant abilities. And so he developed this technique kind of around experimenting with his daughter, where it was basically trying to get your mind to reach this thing called alpha state, where brainwave frequency is 7 to 14 hertz. And it basically is like this, like they say you reach it in the kind of like daydreaming or transition to sleeping state, where you like, he claimed that if you allowed your brain to reach this state of like enhanced awareness, that you could mentally project with a specific intent. And so once the mind is projected, a person could allegedly view distant objects or locations, connect with this higher intelligence, and the information received by the projected mind is then said to be perceived as like thoughts or images or feelings or smells or taste or sound by the mind, and it can be used to solve problems. So it's like basically putting yourself in this like resting state that you then have so much more use of your brain, or like a higher use of, you know, seeing into other places, seeing into the future. It sounds really cool and crazy, and kind of reminds me of like, people have talked about this with LSD. Have you heard all that stuff?
Which stuff?
Like having enhanced abilities, or like,
oh,
connecting
sure.
to something higher through
like seeing, like hearing colors, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically like this mind control tactic, or like all of this method, she really, like Helen, like really dove in and learned all about it and got super involved. But like the weirdest thing to me is that it again is like all after this time of her winning the contest. So I'm like, I guess it was just something that like she really saw like what she was doing with her like positive thinking as like maybe like the baby version of what this was. And so she just got really involved, and then, you know, eventually like got this like doctorate in metaphysics from like an unaccredited institution. Oh. not that exciting. And she kind of like starts to reframe her prior experiences and saying that, you know, all this contest winning was because of the power of positive thinking. And she claimed that her ability to win these contests came from, I'm going to quote this, came from the projection of energy each person possesses, which she called, I guess, like auric energy, like aura. And so she portrayed these contest wins as something that she had been certain of beforehand. Like she then in her books, like goes to talk about how she like picked out the lot that she wanted the Formica home to be in. She drew up plans for this house before she even won. And similarly, like she said, she had already gotten passports and vaccines before she won this foreign trip, because she was like, I mean, seemingly it's very similar to manifesting to me, where it's like she had just like told herself that she was going to win. And so she did win.
So, yeah. So you need to prepare yourself because you're going to win.
Yeah. Wow. And she That's even wild. Goes on to claim that she had developed a telepathic, like she could communicate telepathically with members of her family, particularly her son Chris. And so she claimed that this same like projection of energy technique that she was doing with Silva mind control worked to facilitate telepathy. And so she even believed in her, you know, as she got older, she believed that she had, you know, these definitely like heightened clairvoyance. And she even says in her books that like she thinks everyone has some powers of ESP and clairvoyance, but that you need to like recognize and develop them in order for them to be, you know, more powerful. And so she's just like a super interesting lady, and I wish like there was more, I'm just like more information about like how those two things like linked up, because I'm like, it really to me feels like she tried contest winning for a while, she was super successful at it, whether it was like writing skills or like just, you know, like applying to a bunch of these contests, or like some, you know, maybe it was just like time and effort at like maybe she applied to a million things and won, you know, 20, but that seemed so incredible. Wow. You know,
maybe
so. Yeah. I think it's really interesting that she did kind of like take this contest winning and make it into this career about talking about positive thinking and mind control and all these like sort of like mental, I don't even know what the right word is, just like using these
mental
techniques.
Capability. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's wild.
Yes. And just turned it all into like a successful career for herself.
Good for her. And like, there's definitely like, I mean, I think most people believe in like intuition or like things like that. So it's like, I don't know. I don't not believe in a lot of the stuff that she was probably talking about, but it's whenever things get to like a culty place with people that it's like, yeah.
I know. I'm always like, I don't know if we need to go into like, you have to join my mind control cult.
Yeah.
but
that's
did,
a wild story.
Yes. And she did end up dying in 2010 at age 86. And if you like, if you're interested in this like crazy story, she does have this like amazing, like, I found it on YouTube, but an interview where she talks about how she used positive thinking to win all these awards. So I definitely, if you're interested in her, there is more content to like get to know her, because she's definitely, you know, a little bit of a creature, of a unique woman.
Yes, that's amazing. I can't wait to see a picture of her.
Yes, she definitely, you know, she looks very much like a 50s housewife, and then she definitely looks like a, you know, sweet older woman.
Yeah. Okay. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's my, you know, that's the story of Helen Hadsell and winning a bunch of contests. Maybe we should all just start, you know, power of positive thinking.
I think we must. I also like that both of our stories this week, they weren't necessarily like paranormal, but there's like odd stories.
Yes, definitely. I know. And I think there is something still like a little weird about it.
Oh yeah, definitely. But cool, great job. That was awesome.
Thank you guys for listening this week. We hope you have some sweet, sweet nightmares.